The hardest part awaits them? You're kidding. After all they've been through, it gets worse?
Well, I'm afraid so.
It's Saturday, the 11th of November, when the Mayflower anchors in what would be known later as Provincetown Harbor. On the morning of Sunday, Elder William Brewster leads them in Sabbath day worship, which includes prayers throughout the day. No one works. The Puritans are very strict about not working on Sundays.
Governor Carver?
Yes, Master Jones?
I'm afraid your excursions to the other parts of the Cape will have to wait.
Is there a problem?
Well, sadly, the shallop is in worse condition than we first thought. It will take the crew a few weeks to repair and assemble it.
Weeks? But, Master Jones, winter is upon us.
Well,
we must find our location and build houses.
Then send some of your men on an overland expedition.
I will speak to Captain Standish about leading such an expedition. How are our provisions?
Meager. Oh, there's a bounty of geese and ducks all around us, which will be of good use.
Master Jones, have we seen anything at all of the Indians?
Nothing, Governor. But you can be sure they are watching us.
With some fear, the men assemble to discuss their expedition on land. Miles Standish, a soldier of fortune who'd been hired by the Puritans in Holland to serve as their head of militia, is instructed by John Carver.
Captain Standish, you will take 16 men.
In body armor?
Yes.
Swords?
If you think.
Muskets?
Yes, yes, yes. Take whatever it is you need. But you must be guarded, cautious, prudent, should you encounter the natives. Do not provoke, but think only of your protection. It will not do us well to become enemies with those who we need as friends.
As you wish, Governor. My men are experienced. You need not fear their behavior. As for your own people...
My own, yes. Well, William Bradford has indicated that he wishes to go with you, along with a few others.
So long as they can keep up.
I am certain they'll do their best. But you're not to leave anyone behind.
The men are equipped and set out on Wednesday, the 15th of November. Not all are pleased to see them go.
Must you go, William? Surely there are others.
No, my love. It is for me to go. I cannot ask another to do it.
I'm worried. You do not know the dangers that may await you.
My dear, dear Dorothy. Have we known any of the dangers we've encountered? When we left England for Holland? When we departed for these shores? We have met unknown dangers, and God in his mercy has brought us through them. I will not abandon my faith now, not having come this far. Do not worry. Be at peace. Pray for us.
In freezing temperatures, the expedition force sets out south to explore more than 50 miles of unknown coastline. When they're no more than a mile down the beach, they see something up ahead.
People!
I cannot make it out. Is that Master Jones and his men? They were on shore with one of the dogs this morning.
There is a dog with them.
That's not Master Jones!
Look, they're running away.
Indians! Muskets, men! Muskets! Stop! Might I remind you that I give the orders, Mr. Billington? We will follow them and hope to make good contact.
The men follow the Indians for almost 10 miles, but do not catch up. Night comes upon them, and with guards posted, they set up camp and attempt to sleep. Few do. The next morning, they set off again, following the Indians' tracks. Back at the Mayflower, those left behind wait and watch.
Dorothy?
Elder William?
Why are you on deck? It's covered with ice. You'll make yourself ill.
Would I be better below deck, where so many are ill?
No, still, you should not be out here, exposed to the cold.
I am content.
You are worried for your husband.
They've been gone since yesterday. If anything were to happen to him...
You would place your trust in God as you have all along.
I cannot bear being away from him like this. I wish he had not gone. How are we to know if the men are safe and well?
They will signal us. It has all been arranged. They'll make a large fire on the shoreline. We have men posted to watch for it. Now, please, I beg you, go below.
I will. For now.
Oh, dear woman, Oh, God, protect our men. Bring them home safely. What is that? Does anyone else see that? There, on the horizon.
I see it! It's a fire, Mr. Brewster! The signal!
Oh, praise be to God. The fire. They are safe. Dorothy! Dorothy!
Another night and another morning, and the men continue following the footprints of the Indians. They come upon an abandoned cornfield, and then an Indian burial ground. They continue south, and soon encounter a different site, where the sand has been made purposefully smooth.
Surely this is something to investigate.
It may be. Let us dig to see. The rest of you, form a ring around us, muskets to the ready.
I found something.
What is it?
A basket, I think, made of reeds, and it's full of corn.
There's another here. It's remarkable. The corn is still on a cob, of colors I've not seen.
Colors?
Look, red, blue, yellow.
And they're perfectly dry.
What shall we do with it?
Take it, of course.
Take it. And let that be our introduction to the natives, to show ourselves as thieves.
I'd rather be a live thief than a dead pilgrim.
It's true, William. Who knows if or when we'll come upon provisions such as these? Are you to say that God himself hasn't provided for us to find them?
I will not gainsay it, but we will not steal. Let us consider it a loan. We will make good on what we take.
So be it. We'll put as much corn as we can carry in that kettle and take it back. Perhaps when the shallop is seaworthy, we'll come here for more.
Dusk comes, and with it comes rain. The men create a makeshift shelter of branches and trunks. The next day, they journey back to the Mayflower. They arrive both weary and welcome home.
Oh, William.
Hello, my love. You see, there was nothing to fret about.
No.
The shallop is mended and afloat by Monday, the 27th of November. Master Christopher Jones himself now sails the vessel, filled with over 30 men, across the harbour in the hope of finding a place to settle. The wind blows them to the opposite side, but the tidal flats require them to walk from the boat through the freezing water to get to shore. Their clothes, their stockings, their shoes all freeze. Heavy snow falls. Some of the men begin to feel ill, yet they all march for miles, finally returning to the area where they'd found the stores of the Indians' corn. They have to dig under the snow and frozen earth, where they find 10 more bushels of corn, which they take.
We must keep a strict accounting.
Of course we will, but hurry. My men are getting sick. We must return them to the Mayflower.
Once again aboard the Mayflower, the pilgrims rejoice to learn of the birth of the first child brought into this new world, a son to William and Susanna White. But there's also a death, as Edward Thompson succumbs to an illness. The cold and sickness now work their way through the people of the Mayflower. A much smaller expedition is assembled to go out in the shallop on Wednesday, the 6th of December.
William, this time, please, don't go.
I must go, my love. Have you not noticed? I'm considered a leader now. The others look to me.
Still.
Besides, John Carver is going. The governor himself. This may well be our last expedition. We will find a place to live.
If we live at all.
You must be strong, Dorothy. Don't worry so. Stay below deck and help those who are sick.
I will do my best, but I will watch for you.
Watch and pray, my dearest.
The men sail the shallop south. It is so cold that the spray of the water forms a frozen glaze on their coats. They finally find a place on which to land. Some of the men go ashore and build a shelter that is also meant to serve as a barricade in case of attack. They spend the night.
You see that, don't you, Bradford?
I do. A fire.
How far do you think?
3, possibly 4 miles away.
Could be 10 miles away, and still I will not sleep tonight.
Nor I.
The next day, they continue their search for a place to live. They discover more evidence of the natives in abandoned wigwams and burial sites. But there's no suitable site for them to settle. The men rejoin the shallop and sail into a tidal creek where again they land and establish a barricade for the night. Then, in the middle of the night...
Billington, what is it? Why did you fire?
I saw something there in the brush.
What? Indians?
I'm not sure. It sounded like a dog of some sort, but I thought I saw a man.
Men that howl like dogs? God preserve us.
God preserve us indeed, Mr. Bradford. Wolves, Indians, winter, starvation. I don't believe your God wants anything to do with our venture.
He does, Mr. Billington. Whatever happens, we are in his sure grip.
In the morning, the men rise. Sluggish and tired, they begin to prepare for breakfast. A few of them venture into the woods to gather sticks for the fire, while others go to the water to load the shallop.
Men, I want you to be sure your weapons are in operating order. Powder dry, matchlocks working properly.
Why? You said those were wolves last night.
Still, in this dampness, we must be sure we are armed. If only to shoot fowl for us to eat. Test your weapons. Fire them into the air.
After firing their weapons, one of the men suddenly rushes from the woods.
Alarm! Alarm! Indians! Indians!
To your arms! Do not shoot until you're able to take aim. Waste not your shots until we know their number.
The arrows fly, and the men return fire as quickly as they can.
Men, listen to me. There is one native, there, behind that tree. The most valiant of them. Take full aim for him. If we blast him, the others may take flight. Ready? Fire!
The native leader dodges the bullets that fly around him, but then screams and rushes back into the woods. The rest of the Indians follow.
After them!
Are you mad?
They must not see that we fear them.
The men give chase, but do not catch the Indians. Back at the barricade, they learn that no one has been hurt, though the wet clothes they'd hung to dry are pierced by multiple arrows. In the shallop, the settlers make sail again.
We must pray, my brothers, for it pleased God to vanquish our enemies and give us deliverance. Yet we must also pray for a place to settle, and quickly. Let us press onwards.
The weather now turns bad, and the seas seem determined to thwart the journey. The men struggle to keep control of the boat, which threatens to take them in the wrong direction or to capsize. The mast breaks, and the men row for their lives. In time, they come upon a cove and land. When daylight finally arrives, they are able to explore the area. Robert Cobbin, one of the Mayflower's pilots, sounds out the harbor and discovers that it's suitable for a ship the size of the Mayflower to anchor. Meanwhile, the men find themselves upon a sandy shore that leads to hills and running brooks. There are fields to be cultivated on the hills.
Is this it? Do we settle here?
It is far better than any place we've yet seen.
That hill there rises high, allowing us a view on all sides. It would be a suitable site for a fort to ward off an attack from the Indians.
What do you say, Governor? John?
Winter is here, and will become worse as we approach the heart of it. We must build houses for our people. So many are sick. Yes, this must be our choice.
So, the Puritans, like the Israelites thousands of years before them, have journeyed and found their Canaan. It is Tuesday, the 12th of December, as the shallop returns to the Mayflower. They come bringing good news to the other passengers. But it is not good news that awaits them.
William.
We have met with success, Elder. Thanks be to God.
No doubt Governor Carver will tell us soon enough. But I must speak with you.
What is it? Where is Dorothy? Is she ill?
Not ill, my brother.
Then what is wrong? Why are you at such pains?
William, Dorothy's dead.
No.
Yesterday she fell overboard. We know not how. The deck was icy. She must have slipped. We were below tending the sick. No one heard her cry. We found her much later in the water.
No. No, where is she? I must see her. Dorothy. Oh, my love. Faint not, poor soul. In God we must trust. Fear not the things we must suffer. For whom God loves, he chastises, and then mercifully wipes away all tears from their eyes.
William Bradford's wife died?
After all that, she died the day before they found their new home?
Yeah, that's right. It's very sad. He called her his dearest consort. And remember, they had a 3-year-old son back in Holland.
Well, that's it. I'd call it quits and go back.
I'm sure that some wanted to, but Bradford didn't. He believed that whatever happened, no matter how good or bad, God was at the center of it, working out his purpose.
Wow.
This was a belief that would be tested to the limit.
The following day, Master Christopher Jones sails the Mayflower the 30 miles to the new harbor. They spend another 3 days exploring the entire area and finalizing where the settlement will be built. They decide to call it New Plymouth.
So, where's the rock?
Rock?
You know, Plymouth Rock.
Oh, well, there is a giant rock there, but it's not mentioned in any of the writings of the pilgrims.
Oh, great.
Imagine now a group of 20 or so gathering on the shore to thank God and begin the work of building houses. Storms come, yet trees must be felled and chopped. The provisions must be brought from the ship on rugged waters. And sickness seizes all. Colds, fevers, and scurvy.
Scurvy?
Yeah, it's a terrible sickness caused by a lack of vitamin C, though no one knew that at the time. We would probably say that scurvy feels like the flu. Terrible aches and pains in all the muscles and joints, nausea and tiredness. But add to that bleeding gums and loose teeth, and you have a fairly horrible sickness.
I'm glad I asked.
The Mayflower becomes a floating hospital. People are dying every day. Even Master Jones's stepson succumbs to his illness. This is only the beginning. They had planned to build 19 houses. But with so much death, the number has dropped to 7. The illness is spread, and the single completed house is filled with the sick. Only a dozen people are healthy enough to help the bedridden. By March, 4 entire families are lost to sickness. Surviving orphans are taken in by the remaining families. By winter's end, of the original 102 passengers, only 50 will be left alive. And in the surrounding forest, they hear familiar cries.
They scream to unnerve us. They are succeeding. We will begin regular marches and drills to be certain our men are ready, if and when the Indians come. And we must get our cannons mounted on that hilltop.
Captain Standish, the cannons were brought to fight any attacks from the sea.
Do you truly believe they will be of any use to us should the Indians attack? We fool ourselves. If they come, they will be victorious over us.
I will admit it's a wonder to me that they haven't attacked already. They must know how vulnerable we are.
We have done our best to bury our dead in secret.
We have no secrets from them. They're watching us, and we'll soon make their move when we are at our weakest.
Can it be any worse for us? We are starving to death. Perhaps it would be a merciful act if the Indians came now and put an end to our misery.
I do not believe that God has brought us here to die.
I will ask you if that is what you believe when the Indians arrive at our settlement.
On the 16th of March, as work continues on the houses, an alarm is raised.
Indian! Indian! Arm yourselves!
Someone fetch Governor Carver! Where? Where are they?
Just one. There, on the hill.
One? Oh, I see. We'll chase after him, and he'll lure us into the woods where the rest can attack.
But he's walking towards us. This is it! This is the attack! Shoot him!
Be calm, man!
The Indian does not hesitate as he walks towards the settlers, but comes at them boldly. The men gather with their muskets, prepared for a trick, a surprise. The Indian continues on. Finally, some of the militia block his path.
Stop where you are. We cannot let you go further.
The Indian smiles at them, and then he salutes.
Welcome, Englishman.
He spoke English?
Oh, that's right.
He is a tall man with long black hair and a hairless face. Apart from a leather strap around his waist, he is naked. One of the men throws a coat over his shoulders, if not because of the cold, then for modesty's sake.
I am thirsty.
Thirsty?
Yes, Captain Standish. If he is thirsty, then we must give our guests something to drink. Let us go into the common house.
Yes, Governor.
Bring food.
Food, of course. Food, Captain Standish.
It goes without saying.
What is your name?
Samoset.
Samoset. I am John Carver, the governor of this settlement.
I know.
How is it that you speak our language?
I learned to speak in your tongue from Englishmen who fish in the north. I come here because the great Sachem Massasoit sent me. He is leader of the Poconoket people. He does not hate you like other tribes here. He wants to meet with you.
Ah, then we must talk, Samoset. We have much to discuss.
They talk throughout the day. Samoset tells them about the region where they've settled, the names of the places, how the Indians there died of a terrible plague a few years before. He eats, drinks, and spends the night. The next morning...
I will return. There is another of our people, Squanto, who speaks your tongue better. Together we will come with more men.
Goodbye, Samoset.
Did he say... more men?
Less than a week later, on the 22nd of March, Samoset returns to the Plymouth settlement. He comes with four other Indians, including the one called Squanto. The settlers are pleased to speak with one who knows their language so well, and who is also able to talk of England and Spain, where he had lived as a slave. The Indians also brought furs and fish for trade. The settlers were hopeful. Then Squanto informed them.
We are not alone. The great Sachem Massasoit is here to meet you.
Here? Now?
Imagine the worry that goes through the settlement, with so many of them sick, dying, and unable to defend themselves. Imagine how they feel when they look to the hills and see Massasoit coming with a large group of his braves, their faces painted and each one armed with a bow and arrows. Squanto translates for Massasoit.
The great Sachem greets you, as we greet him on behalf of our king, with love and peace.
Gifts are exchanged, and the two leaders, Massasoit and Governor Carver, retreat to the common house to agree on a treaty between the settlers and the Poconokets. At the end of it, Squanto remains with the settlers, tasked with the responsibility of helping them to fish and plant crops. Without knowing it, Squanto becomes an answered prayer for the weary and starving Puritans.
God could not have surprised us more. To send the Indians, the ones we thought of as enemies, to be the source of our aid. We would all be dead otherwise.
Squanto guides the pilgrims through the next planting season and to a great harvest. A harvest they share in a great feast with their Indian allies. On that day, they give thanks to God, for they now see the realization of the promises they believed he'd made to them in Holland, to live in peace and prosperity, worshipping him in true freedom. And so, this part of the Puritan story ends as it began, with hope.
I hope you understand a little better now. So much of what we enjoy in our country, we enjoy because of what they did. And what they did because they were moved by God to do it.
Wow.
Amazing.
But I'm still trying to imagine myself doing what they did. To believe in God so much and to put my life on the line.
Well, isn't that what God wants from all of us who claim to follow him?
Well, yeah, but...
It's easy to forget. We lose sight of how God works in the big picture. It nearly happened to the Puritans.
Really? When?
Well, the Puritans, who eventually became known as the Pilgrims, created a successful plantation. Years went by, and more Puritans came from Europe. Some of the newcomers looked in wonder at what the Pilgrims had accomplished, but there were those who enjoyed what the Pilgrims had built without appreciating what they'd sacrificed. William Bradford wrote a detailed account of the Pilgrims' adventures in his Of Plymouth Plantation, in part so that generations to come might understand what they had endured and why. Here, listen close to what he wrote.
We were moved by a great hope, an inward zeal of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way for the propagating and advancing of the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world. Yea, though we should even be but stepping stones for others to perform so great a work. As one candle may light a thousand, I have noted these things so that you may see their worth, and not negligently lose what your fathers have obtained with so much hardship.
They considered themselves stepping stones?
Well, isn't that what we all are when we think of the bigger story that God is telling? Aren't we here now to play our part, to do the very best we can for him?
That's a lot to think about.
It sure is. And I hope you will. Oh, by the way, there is one last quote from William Bradford to consider. It's one of my favorites. Thus, out of small beginnings, greater things have been produced by his hand that made all things of nothing and gives being to all things that are. And as one small candle may light a thousand, so the light here kindled hath shone to many, yea, in some sort, to our whole nation. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all the praise.